This week on Oval Office, Iran is now at the centre of global headlines. In recent days, tensions between Iran, the United States and Israel have escalated, with military strikes and naval action taking place over the last week. Beginning on Saturday the 28th of February, conflict has now still continued as the situation continues to evolve. Entering its fourth day, America has just sunk a key Iranian naval ship off the coast of Sri Lanka, whilst Iran continues to launch strikes on American military bases and energy points, as well as strikes in Israel. These effects are also being felt beyond the Middle East, including economic uncertainty in countries like the UK, where markets have started to react to rising instability and potential energy disruption. In this episode, we'll break down what's happening with our guest of the week, Deputy Head Mr. Wayman, as we discuss why it matters in global politics and what the next possible steps could be. Mr. Wayman, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, boys.
So, firstly, I wanted to ask you about the history behind Iran. These countries, America and Iran and Israel, are constantly in the news over conflict, and they have been for nearly half a century. So I wanted to ask you about the history behind that.
So it's complex, like all these things, and in many ways it's where in history or prehistory do you want to begin. But to keep things simple, I think the key date we all need is 1979. That's the year when Iran moves from being a autocratic monarchist state to a theocratic state, and effectively transitions from one which has espoused culturally liberal expressions in the late 70s towards education, women's rights and other sort of signal areas, to one which is controlled by the Shiite religious leadership. This then puts Iran into an explicitly antagonistic relationship with Israel as the geographically closest country to harboring explicit Western values, and by extension the Western world itself, as most visibly represented through America. And so since 1979 there have been flashpoints and tensions between Iran, Israel and European US coalitions.
Yeah, I think it's also really interesting on the topic of, for the last now at least 30 years, there have been claims from both Israel and America of Iran's nuclear facilities being more and more advanced, them having an atomic weapon, and the dangers of Iran having an atomic weapon, which has been the main reasoning from the Pentagon and from Israel as to why these strikes are being carried out. I think that it's an interesting point of view, especially when intelligence around nuclear facilities in Iran have been a bit fuzzy. Less than a year ago, during the 12-day war, obviously, America had bombed the three nuclear facilities that Iran had, and according to Trump, had obliterated their nuclear facilities. However, here we are, less than a year later, having the Navy and the army all being obliterated as well. It's quite funny how those points come back around, right?
It is. There are a couple of things. Firstly, countries have seen from North Korea that if you can successfully develop a nuclear weapon, you have a phenomenal international currency. And that brings you the grudging respect, the horrified respect of the most powerful people in the world, as we saw during Trump's first presidency when he walked and talked with the North Korean leader. The other thing that maybe explains how we are where we are is that Trump is a leader against a stopwatch. He has a finite amount of time left constitutionally on his second term. And already this year, he has practiced a decapitation strike on Venezuela. And he did it in a similar form, insofar as he sent various military representatives, either in terms of hardware, boats, ships, to engage in a fairly pronounced, visible, explicit build-up, and then went and got, in a daring overnight raid, the leadership. And he's clearly indifferent to the what he would term politically correct mode of going through diplomacy as overseen by the UN, and just believes in a very unilateral, unambiguous, physical leadership-first approach to foreign policy, which would appeal to a particularly literally-minded demographic and who want to see something very visible. One of the first things he said after the initial strike was to be very, I suppose he was boastful that he was doing what other presidents had failed to do. So we're dealing with a mode of presidency as much as we are with a historical issue.
Mm. It's funny how you mention international law there. I think that in an age of how we are now all of a sudden seeing conflicts in Eastern Europe, such as in Ukraine and Russia, as well as, you know, overnight takeovers with Trump in Venezuela, and also now strikes in Iran, how this looks for international law and the supposed like decaying of international law and its legitimacy around countries. How much do you think that this conflict in particular is affecting international law and its credibility?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. I think it is a signal test of it. And you can just see that through the very fact that this morning's headlines were Trump saying that Starmer's no Churchill. Starmer, lawyer by trade, is very mindful of international law and very mindful of the trauma the country went through as a result of the support for the US invasion of Iraq in 2005, and how that effectively has entirely cast Tony Blair's legacy in the light in which it is held. Starmer's quite calibrated decision to seek a legalistic approach is appearing, as the urgency of war unfolds, to be timorous. And Trump is no doubt exasperated, but also probably rather enjoying the humiliation of belittling Starmer, because it emboldens his, Trump's, own image. At the same time, because Trump is now coalescing a group called, is it the Peace Board, as a quasi-UN alternative made up from countries who have an interesting history of it, respect for human, for international law, and is in many ways typified by the absence of those who are more cautious in their respect for international law. I think we are seeing a new world order of sorts. So much of this will depend on how far Trump in 2.5 years is succeeded by someone who's got the same view as him, or whether this will go with him.
I think one of the, as you've just been talking about international law, one of the points that could be quite interesting is how that could possibly affect the relationship between the UK and the US. So obviously you had the incident between Starmer initially declining the usage of UK bases for the US, which then he U-turned on and has now allowed usage. But that was down to his reading of international law, whether that declared the UK is involved. How do you imagine the UK and the US's relationship will move forward? And will the current stability issues or predictability issues still remain no matter what?
I think all recognize that in Trump they have a leader who has a petulance which can be as exacerbated or assuaged according to their next move. So not unlike an infant. And well, I'm not calling Trump a tyrant. I'm certainly making an analogy between, a bit like King Lear, there's quite an analogy between infantile behavior and megalomaniac behavior, because fundamentally it's very hard for an infant or someone who has a lust for power to distinguish between themselves and the world. They think they are the world. To return to your point, I think what is true today is rarely true tomorrow at the moment with Trump, because in an ethic where people are flattered and then exasperated, there's something very unpredictable. We saw it with Zelensky when he was hounded out of the White House and humiliated on day one, and by day 30, it's a much more collaborative relationship. The trouble with the UK is we forever espouse this special relationship with the US, and that's something which is both really important, but is also one which is maybe going to be increasingly one which, depending on what Trump decides to do next, is very hard to justify. So I think the next week or so will be really interesting. It's going to take a week for our warship to arrive. But maybe our lack of gung-ho urgency will, in historical terms, be seen to be a very valuable asset, given there seems to be no explicit plan with how Iran is going to move forward from this, other than the hope that when the bomb stops falling, everyone's going to rush out from their shelters and form a new nation state.
Yeah, it does seem to me like if we look at headlines, everybody seems to be very worried about the special relationship, as it sounds, because of comments de Churchill saying that we're not dealing with the right kind of leader. Those kinds of comments will make headlines, obviously, saying that, you know, if we go back to revisiting how this relationship was, we can clearly see that it isn't moving in the direction that maybe the UK would want it to, or America either. It's not really in their interest, the way that, as well, Britain is kind of becoming this weird kind of like tug of war between Europe and America, and how it tries to form a sort of bridge between the two. However, with Starmer trying to reset ties with Europe, that comes with the price of dealing with an American side that's obviously going to be opposed to that. It is also worth mentioning a great analogy, which is the one of Zelensky and Trump. We have seen previously that what seems like destroyed relationships in a very short period of time can change them into ones that, you know, sounded like they were rewritten completely on the drawing board.
Yeah, very much. I mean, England, UK has always had an intermediary role between the US and Europe. Both the World Wars demonstrated that. And if this escalates or modulates into another version of a global conflict, I can see the UK again very much holding that uneasy space as a geographical and global middle ground. However, it will only take one incident which has an emotive and explicit impact on the UK to radically alter public opinion on all of this. And that's one of the mercurial features of warfare. And I'm very conscious at the time of speaking, we have many members of our community, families, friends who are in the Middle East, in the UAE in particular. And so while, you know, the discussion we're having is helpfully political and incisive, I'm very conscious there are members of the community who might be listening to this who are feeling things on a much more emotional than cognitive level at the moment. And I think it's important we just acknowledge that as part of this interview.
Of course, yeah. Of course, with some frightening escalations, and I think it's definitely worth addressing the fact that we as a community obviously need to maintain as strong support as in any country of conflict and in any country to make sure that people are knowledgeable of what's happening in these regions. But one thing that I wanted to ask about was the topic of success in this situation. So to obviously all of America, Israel and Iran, success may look a bit different, but I wanted to touch basis on what you thought the idea of success might be for America in this operation.
I think one idea that personally I'd put forward is whether actually there is an idea of success for the US. Because I think that's something you really need to look at, whether there is a plan as such. But please continue.
Yeah, it's, I think this is why there is hesitancy amongst European states at the moment for being involved, because they don't know what success looks like. Back in the first decade of the 20th century with Iraq and Afghanistan, where regime change occurred, and if you, you know, that involves boots on the ground. And the moment you start to put military personnel into another country, you start tragically to lose military personnel in another country, and you start to lose public support for that, at which point your operation is jeopardized if you are trying to reconstruct, you know, to move from one governmental system to another. Starmer had an interesting line earlier in the week that you don't change regime from the skies. I thought that was a memorable phrase. In other words, you can't bomb your way into it. Now, Trump has already said in his opening kind of exhortation to the Iranian people what he thinks success looks like. Clearly, he's building on the student demonstrations from earlier in the year and last year, where there was a degree of momentum. There's a very large young population in Iran, where there is clearly an appetite for change. It would seem that the US definition of success is to clear the military and religious rulers out the way so that a young, democratic, liberal uprising can occur from the streets. As he said, your chance won't come again for generations. To put the onus on the Iranian people, who have no formal organized democracy, is ambitious to say the least. If we were to then use Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria and Libya and the other countries where attempts were made to either become involved, fund involvement, advertise involvement, at its very bleakest, the best measure of success is that you don't have an automatically failed state. And that's a horrendous contemplation, because as we've just seen in Afghanistan, the moment the boots leave the ground, the single most dominant force in the shape of the Taliban will retake it. And so it relies upon such a simplistic view of change just to eliminate a scion of people. However, underneath all of this is to return to the point that if Iran is no longer able to function as a nuclear bomb-producing country, that arguably would be seen as a measure of success. But the entire region is reactivated as a militarized one, where the prize of nuclear uranium enrichment becomes all the stronger for it. So it's very, very hard to see. But broadly speaking, it goes everything from the least worst option through to not having a nuclear capability. But you can't bomb an idea out of people. That's the problem with regime change.
One of the final questions we have, I think, would be around the outlook of it. So with the origin, or do you think with different leaders, etc., do you think a peaceful resolution could have been found?
I don't feel it was inevitable. I think the assembling of an American armada made it feel as though it was inevitable.
Yeah.
But of course, those were all strategic decisions against, yes, a very real and extended backdrop of nuclear threat. And of course, we had seen some surgical strikes, as they're euphemistically called, last year. Inevitability is the name that people give to strategy which tries to cover its own tracks. So I think with different leadership, you are in a position to maneuver things. And not forgetting that while theocratic in structure, Iran does have a president as well as an ayatollah. And historically, Iran's presidents have not all been from the same cloth and have been open to a different form of dialogue. And so I think it's going to be interesting to see how this evolves. But I can guarantee you this, will not be swiftly over. It might be swiftly over in terms of a military conflict, but what grows in place of what has been annihilated will be a generational issue.
Yeah, I think that if we look strategically in the eyes of America, if we look at Iran's current situation, there have been huge uprisings from the youth in protests. Not only that, but if we look at the key Iranian allies, we're looking at Russia, who's currently in a struggling winter in war with Ukraine, making them fundamentally unable to provide support for Iran. And when we look at China, we look at them still continuing their policy of playing the long game with America. No serious foreign involvements there. Involvement in conflict between America and China has all undermined by the Chinese. There's no real involvement there. And all in all, I think that brings us to our final point. We could see how this is definitely a conflict that's been created strategically in a time where the Iranian regime has been struggling. We can see that the timescale of this conflict in terms of military action is definitely uncertain. Thank you very much, Mr. Wayman.
Thank you very much.
For a very enjoyable episode. Obviously, if you are struggling with this kind of news, it can be a very sensitive subject, as well as having family or relatives nearby in those areas of conflict. There are numerous different support sources around Wellington, and we will see you next week on the Oval Office. Thank you so much for listening. Mm-hmm.